www.thebrainfarm.com.
This is Chris Evans with a Storage Unpacked podcast, and I'm here with Bill Schmozzo from Hitachi Vantara. Hi, Bill. How are you?
Great, Chris. How are you doing?
Not bad at all. Thank you very much. So we've never met before. This is a bit of an off the cuff conversation. First time we've met. First time we've even spoken to each other, which is always fun for a podcast recording. But I'm sure we'll be fine. Now, anybody who is aware should know Hitachi Vantara is partly an infrastructure and hardware company, but actually to a certain degree a data company. So could you just tell us what you do for the company, and then we'll dive into our conversation topic for today?
Yeah, Chris, so it's a good explanation. What Hitachi Vantara is think of us as being the digital arm of the larger Hitachi. We've got storage products that help manage all this data. We have the software around securing it. We're also building out a lot of the analytics and edge capabilities for us to facilitate the capture and the interrogation of that data. And we have a services organization that really focuses on helping organizations to get value out of that data.
Mm-hmm. And what do you do particularly?
Oh my gosh, yes. I'm the chief innovation officer. Yes, I have a job and I'm the chief innovation officer. And my background is very much into advanced analytics.
Okay, fantastic. So somebody suggested that we should have a conversation. And thank you very much for them for introducing us. But obviously, I talk to Hitachi a lot, so you know it's good to talk to just a different arm of the company. Your focus around innovation and the use of data and monetization of data, I think, is quite an interesting topic, because a lot of what we talk about is usually focused around the technology, the storing of the data, backing it up, blah, 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 you know, which obviously is great and all has to be done. But once you've actually got data, you need to do something useful with it. So how is it you focus on that side of things, and what is it you do in order to actually, for want of a better word, monetize this, Bill?
So the conversations that one needs to have in order to drive a monetization initiative is very different than where our traditional part of our organization focuses. And in particular, the basic fact is having data is of no value. In fact, having data costs money. You got to store it, got to protect it, you got to worry about it getting broken into and liability and such. So it's one of these things that it's like a shark. If you don't use it, you're going to lose it. So me and my team, we focus in on is how do we help organizations figure out you've got a bevy of data, most of which, by the way, is probably not very useful. But there are some sets of data you have that are very critical with respect to what you're trying to do from a business perspective. And yeah. If I could say, Chris, probably the most important question I ask my customers when we start the conversation is really, how effective is your organization at leveraging data and analytics to power your business models? Right. So it's not having data as a source of value. The source of value is how you're using it to really drive the business.
Right. Got you. I mean, at the end of the day, you've got, as you said, you've got to have data from somewhere. You've got to find it. You've got to acquire it. You've got to store it. I've always thought it's very interesting that we had a long conversation with this idea of, or we've had a long history of this idea of not throwing data away, because we'd always thought it would be useful at some point. I guess as a starting point, you must have to at least try and work out what the customer has and try and put some sort of value or usage to it that says, here's how we could actually start using this data in other areas or something like that.
So the way that we start the monetization conversation is by talking to the business executives about what is it the business is trying to accomplish over the next 12 to 18 months. Some are trying to reduce unplanned operational downtime. Some are trying to improve customer retention or quality of care if you're a hospital or whatever it might be. But every organization has what we call these business initiatives. And associated with these business initiatives is usually value. You know, improving customer retention by 2% might be worth, you know, $50 million to the organization. That's where we're going to start the value conversation. Let's understand what it is you're trying to accomplish. And then let's go through we call it a value engineering process to bring in all the different stakeholders to understand where and how we might be able to use data to really improve something like customer retention or reduce unplanned operational downtime. But it has to start with that, with what is the source of value for that unique organization.
Right. That seems like it'd be very difficult for you to put some sort of process around, because it could be anybody in the organization who's creating the data. It could be many different parts of the organization who want to use data. it's not like you can just, you know, walk into the CTO and say, here's a new storage box. You know, you're potentially talking to a huge swathe of different people across the organization.
The biggest challenge, Chris, is not that organizations lack use cases. The biggest challenge is they have too many. So right. There's too many different places where you can apply data and analytics to drive value. So we run we call it a digital value envisioning process, where we take the executives and we go through a process of trying to help them understand where and how they could use data, identifying all the different use cases they could go after, and then helping them to value and prioritize those. So the heart of the conversation before we ever start doing any of the data science work is to make sure we understand to identify, validate, value, and prioritize the use cases they want to go after. So it has become very, very laser-like focus on one particular use case and then figuring out what data supports that use case, what advanced analytics support that use case. And then what's interesting, Chris, is you can literally go use case by use case and attack the next problem, leveraging what you built in the first use case to accelerate your time to value and de-risk projects for your second, third, and ... use cases.
Okay, so we come at it from a top-down perspective then. So we're coming at it and saying, we're solving a business problem, and then you go looking for the data.
Yes.
That sounds exactly the way you're saying.
Yeah, because what we find is if you don't do that, it's hard to figure out what data is valuable. And even if you think you have a valuable data set, it's hard to distinguish what's signal from noise within that data set unless you know what problem you're trying to solve. So the use case by use case approach gives us a framework for making those decisions about what data we're going to actually put in our data lake, right? Which means we're going to curate it, we're going to transform it, metadata management, governance, all those sort of things. Doing all that stuff to data is very expensive. If you don't know how you're going to monetize that data, you're throwing a lot of money down the toilet.
Yeah, and that gets back to that discussion about you could be storing a lot of data that you don't ever need to store. And that always worries me. Well, it doesn't worry me, I guess, in some respects, because it's more work to do to look after it. I guess if you're an administrator, you probably enjoy that. But it is a challenge because some of that data might be growing very, very quickly. Some of it might be quite static. So it is quite important to make sure you make the right decisions about which data is going to add value to your organization.
Yeah, and it impacts things such as simple as what's in hot versus cold storage. I mean, there's lots of data architecture and data management decisions that you are going to make once you know which of your data sources are most important to drive in business value.
Okay, so you're in there with the customer, you're creating a strategy for them around how you're going to take their data and you're going to build something. What's the next step? You know, is it to start building models around how you bring that data into the infrastructure? Or what do you do next?
So what our next step is, after we've gone through a process of getting cross-organizational alignment on the use case roadmap, we pick one and we prove it out. Because what we find is if we don't prove there's value in it, we don't build that kind of cross-organizational support for it. Most of these data science analytic projects, they don't die because of technology. They typically die because of passive-aggressive behavior in the organization. Like some senior executive's voice didn't get heard, and so they're going to get you, right? So what we do is we basically do a proof of value to show them how we can solve that problem so they can start to feel comfortable and confident that data can really help them be successful. And what's interesting about this, Chris, you do that first proof of value, and you show outrageous ROI. I mean, come on, this is like printing money. You couldn't find a job anything easier in the world, right? You do that first one, and all of a sudden, you're overwhelmed. Everybody now wants to do this. It's like, wow, this is really easy. This is great, which poses a second problem, which is you need to have a governance process in place now to go through and figure out, okay, what data are we going to put in the data lake next? What analytics are we going to build out next? What storage? I mean, everything now, the data, the storage, the analytics, all of that architecture, technology, all those things fall out when you start thinking about it from that use case by use case perspective.
So, one of the things that worries me about that side of it, and it's good you mentioned the governance side, and that is, it strikes me that there is a bit of a challenge here that if you've got different data sources that have come from different places, one of the things you have to be very careful about is deciding which ones are allowed to be used in other use cases. So, for instance, there might be some information that relates to me personally or indirectly personally, but not directly. And as a result, you might say, well, if we merge that data into this other data set, Do we need to get permission to use that data? Do we need to anonymize it, etc.? You know, so there must be some real challenges about making sure that you don't just add a data source into your data lake and then suddenly have people using it without any governance around it.
Right. So part of this valuation process we go, or this envisioning process, is to think about a 2x2 matrix where one of the axes is business value from low to high, and the other axis is feasibility from low to high. And so what you'd find in a situation you just described, Chris, is you have situations where HIPAA data or PII data or other sort of data sets make that use case less feasible because you got to mass data, you got anonymized data. But what you're at least doing is you're making those decisions in a way that are very focused and localized. The challenge is if you try to mask all of your data, you're going to spend your entire career just masking data and you'll never get to the valuation part. Yeah. So it allows us to become very laser-like in what we do and then build out, as you said, those governance issues, use case by use case, making sure that each use case thoroughly understands the governance and privacy kind of requirements.
And what are the components then in terms of how you work out the cost? Because one of them must be the physical infrastructure. One of them might be the collection process. How do you actually sit there and build a model out of it? I'll just highlight the fact that Dave Merrill, who used to work for you, I think he's now retired, he had his storage economics, let's call it a methodology, where he had all sorts of different parameters and metrics, and he would use that to allow people to work out how to build out the cost of their infrastructure. Do you do something similar, or have you got a completely different approach?
So we work with our storage folks who understand that. I mean, like you said, that got left behind as one of our value points. Yeah. So that we know that storage isn't, you know, there's a lot of components to cost of storage and managing storage, including risks associated with, you know, security breaches and stuff. You need to factor all of that in. And then you weigh that against the value of the use case. And you might find that in certain use cases, while the use case value may be really compelling, the overall cost to go after that use case makes no sense. It's too expensive. It's too risky from a PII perspective. And so you have to have those two dimensions, the dimension of what's the value and then the dimension of the feasibility risk. So you're making thoughtful decisions about what use cases to go after.
So I may ask you to, if you do have a sample graph that shows those two axes, to let me have that after we finish this recording, because you're drawing that for anybody, obviously, who's listening, they're not going to see the fact that we are actually on video to help us. And you're doing little diagrams to me across the airwaves. And that isn't going to translate to me on a podcast. So maybe we'll put in something into the show notes that shows those two axes on a graph so we can help people understand that, because that sounds to me like one of the sort of key parts of what you're doing here.
I'll send you, I've written several blogs on, we call it the prioritization matrix that looks at those two dimensions. And I will tell you as a management consultant, it's the most powerful tool I have, because I can use that matrix with all the senior business executives to go through a process on a flip chart, right, on a whiteboard with post-it notes, to really have a dialogue that clarifies what are the value components, what are all the areas, but what are the risk components as well? So that when we walk into that first use case, our eyes are wide open. We know what the risks are. But I will send you the link to that prioritization matrix blog and how we've used that over the years to really drive organizational alignment around targeting the right use cases.
Right. Lovely. So what happens when you do this and data sits in an environment for a certain length of time? Because initially you start this process off and you get some value out of it and you're collecting this data. Do things change over time? Do you have to sort of reevaluate this every so often and decide this use case is still valid and we should continue? You know, can that change over time?
So what happens here, Chris, is after you do that first use case, target one, you do the proof of value. By the way, if you can't prove the value, you don't do it, right? You do a POV because you're going to invest, you know, $300,000 to prove you can do it, not $20 million, right, to find out, oops, you can't do it. Yeah. You do that first use case, you prove it out, and then you operationalize it. You probably want to go back to your prioritization matrix, because the work that you've done on that first use case may take those use cases that were initially not very feasible and made them a lot more feasible, right? And it also can take things that were at a lower value, but now I can couple them with those, that use case raises the value of those. So this prioritization matrix becomes one of our governance tools. We use this all the time with customers. We do a use case, we come back, we reevaluate. Do a use case, come back, reevaluate. At some point in time, you know, they're doing that on their own. It becomes a very natural part of how they're thinking about it. So that they're making their data and analytic decisions thoughtfully driven by both ROI as well as risk.
Okay. It's a totally different approach to focusing on the infrastructure side of things. So,
Chris, can I add one point to this? This is a really interesting point. So when you do this use case by use case approach, and this was part of, I did a research project at the University of San Francisco where I'm a executive fellow. And the beauty of doing research projects at a university is you have access to a lot of really smart, motivated, free resources. Yeah. And we tackled this problem about how to determine the value of data. And I won't go into the whole research. It was a series of unlearning moments for me. But one of the things that came out of this was that in knowledge-based industries, the economies of learning are more powerful than economies of scale. And what that means is what you learn on that first use case from a data and analytics architecture, feasibility, risk, governance perspective, you can apply to the second one. You can reapply to the third one. That if you take a very thoughtful process, that you can literally build out your organizational tribal knowledge, use case by use case, and accelerate the time to value by also de-risking projects.
And is this very much an industry-specific thing in terms of the way you would develop that model? Or
nope.
Do you find it's applicable across everything?
Anybody who's got use cases, it works. Anybody who's got data and analytics, it works. Now, every organization has a different set of use cases they're going after because every organization is slightly different. But the methodology works, and I've used it at casinos, theme parks, universities, hospitals. I mean, you pick an industry and we've used this, and it's really the key to it is making sure you've got both organizational buy-in at the top to collaborate and envision and prioritize, but you also have a methodology or a process to educate the people at the front line so that when you start delivering these insightful analytics, they know where and how to use them to make their jobs more effective.
Okay, and I guess does that then become part of that feedback loop, I guess, is what you just described.
Amen,
Oh, look, we've just done something really great. Let's make sure we continue to do something really great, and we loop it back around and we carry on again.
That's exactly right. So if you think about it from a technology perspective, with technology like AI and machine learning, I can build analytic assets that are continuously learning and adapting, right? The more that they're used, the smarter they're getting, right? It makes total sense, and that's part of my chief innovation officer role is to be focused on building those continuous learning and adaptive analytics. But on the human side, it's also the same thing. If you empower the humans who are continuously learning and adapting, and you marry the AI continuous learning and adapting with the human empowerment at the front lines, you end up with, well, digital transformation. You totally transform, you reinvent your organization's value creation processes.
So are there any good examples of where you can see where people have been, I guess, driven and not, I was going to use the word incentivized, I don't mean incentivized, where they've been enthused to start thinking further about the sort of data and analytics they could do. You know, have you gone into places and they've come up with that first use case, and then suddenly, because they've been so successful, it's sparked a generation of dozens of other scenarios?
Yes, I've done this in a number of industries. As you can expect, we're not really allowed to talk about it.
No.
Because really, Chris, it is like printing money.
Yeah.
There's that realization that goes, oh my gosh, if I can use the, I mean, think about data. Data as an asset is unlike any other asset an organization's ever seen. Data never depletes, never wears out. The same data set can be used across an infinite number of use cases at a zero marginal cost. Right? The multiplier effect, the economic multiplier effect of it is staggering. And when a company realizes that, and there are a few out there, probably the most noteworthy one is like Tesla, right? Tesla's autonomous cars are driven by a master AI analytic asset that runs a bunch of other things, and it's continuously learning and getting smarter. So that any one of the 600,000 Tesla cars that get in an accident, every other car learns from that accident and becomes smarter and more valuable. I mean, it's that model is right in front of us, happening every day. But unfortunately, not very many organizations are thinking about the data and analytics as an economic asset and how I can not only reuse it over and over again, but if I construct it right, it can continuously learn and get smarter, in many cases with minimal human intervention.
That's amazing, isn't it? That just makes me think about valuation now, of course, because now my data is suddenly becoming significantly more valuable, and either I need to make sure nobody's going to steal it, which is going to be really one important thing, and I have to make sure nobody's going to actually lose it, so
yeah.
Or corrupt it, or other things are going to happen. So that must have a significant factor for some organizations who look at it and think, wow, this is such a valuable resource now. We need to rethink about how we're actually managing it.
It's so, Chris, you're spot on. And you would think that any organization that gives us any sort of level of thought would go, I get it. This is a game changer. But the number of organizations that think like that is still very small. You still have senior executives, especially on the IT side. These are senior executives who became CIOs because, you know, they survived the SAP ERP implementation. Right,
yeah.
Multi-year, $50 million, cost thousands of lives, and they finally got it done, right? And it took them, you know, 5 to 7 years, right? The Big Bang projects have created a series of CIOs who don't know how to think more incrementally. So where I see biggest impact happening is in small and medium-sized businesses, especially medium-sized businesses, where you've got a CIO who has a vision for how things are different, and can work with the CEO and the executive ranks to really transform how the organization attacks problems. So we've got a long ways to go on this. I'm just finishing up my fourth book here, Chris. It's called The Economics of Data Analytics and Digital Transformation. I mean, it's a real snore book, right? It's boring as all get out. But it really seeks to help organizations think about data and analytics. There's an economic basis for why this is an asset that's a game changer. And why only a handful of customers out in the world have really cracked the code on this is kind of amazing to me.
It must be really a challenge. Sorry, it must be both a challenge and sometimes a bit disheartening when you go into organizations and some people must be really sort of like, yeah, I get it, and they're straight into it. And then others, they're like, but I don't see why this is going to be relevant. Because, you know, we do talk an awful lot about the value of data and data being the new oil, water, or any sort of, you know, commodity resource that people like to sort of assign it to at any particular time. But it must be really good fun and disheartening when you do get people who are on both sides of that that discussion.
It's great when the light bulb goes off. And I'll tell you a story. We were doing a project kicking off with the executive team to take this approach. And I had made the comment that there are certain analysts out there who believe that there will at some point in time in a very near future be more data stored at the edge than there is in the cloud. And there was one of the executives in the room kind of, you know, grabbed his forehead and goes, oh my gosh, how are we going to manage all that data? And you can see this sort of ripple of fear go across the organization. Mm-hmm. And then one of the executives said, well, no, wait, no, that's the wrong perspective. It's not how are we going to manage all that data. The real question is how are we going to monetize all that data? And I knew I had my sponsor.
Yeah.
I knew I had the sponsor who was willing to change how they thought. So a big part of this, Chris, is how do you get management team to let go of what they thought about data in the past and embrace a new future where data is an economic asset? The data is a new oil is a great metaphor, because in the same way that oil fueled the economic growth in the 20th century, data will be the catalyst that drives economic growth in the 21st century. When you find people who believe that, my job is a blast. It's just so much fun. You know why it's fun? Because you're helping customers make money, helping improve their customers. You're helping every aspect. It's so much fun. But there, at this point in time, they're still rare, far and few between people who get that.
So it strikes me, though, that the oil comparison can sometimes be a bit of a loose comparison, because if you look at oil to a certain degree, maybe say gold or some other things, it's still really a finite resource. Theoretically, it's a finite resource.
Yes.
I know we haven't got anywhere near the end of exploiting it, but it seems to me that data is not a finite resource, because it is all down to your creativity to work out what are the data sources you can create. And there's part of your work which is all about, once you've actually created that data source, doing something with it. But there must be some angle of being creative enough to realize that there's a new way to create data and to actually make up new data sources.
That's a good point, Chris, because there is. And what we find is that when we talk to not the executives in an organization, but the people who are closer to the front lines, they have all kinds of other, they have ideas of other data sources they'd like to capture. Right. And they're the ones who have these, you know, oh, we could easily capture this if everybody was wearing, like, you know, a magic band on their wrists, or we built an app on their phone and we got permission to track. I mean, they have all these ideas. The best ideas in an organization don't exist at the top of the organization. They exist in the middle of the organization where people are actually getting shit done, right? And yeah. So you're right. It's the beauty of this is we don't have to drill new wells. Or maybe it is like a new well to find oil, but we've got people all the time, like I said, who have creativity and say, well, what if we tried this? And the ability to leverage this might, right? Let's try this. This might be useful. That ability to leverage and innovate around might becomes critical, because if you don't have enough might moments, you'll never have any breakthrough moments. You got to try lots of things. And a lot of them are going to fail. 9 out of 10 are going to fail. 99 out of 100 are going to fail. But it's that one out of 100 that provides that kind of insights that transforms your economic value curve.
Yep. You mentioned just a minute ago there, Bill, and I should have probably come back to it and mentioned it, but that you do teach, and you know, your free resources to go off and do things. What makes you want to get involved in that side of things?
So, Chris, you kind of hit it on the head when you asked me if I get frustrated dealing with executives who don't get it. And my release valve is really dealing with students who really, for the most part, don't have any preconceived things holding them back. Right? You can throw a new idea at them, and they immediately grok to it, and they jump on it, and they explore it, and they push it. And yeah. and I love teaching, because not only can I throw a new idea at them and let them bounce it around, but in many times what happens is I'm the one who learns more from that process than they do. And that happens because as someone who's been in this industry for 40 years, I have a lot of baggage I'm carrying around, a lot of old ideas, old rules of thumbs this is the way we do things. And yep. It's really hard to unlearn those old things and then embrace something new. So I enjoy working with students, because more times than not, they teach me more than I'm teaching them.
Mm. I'll give you an example of that. So my youngest son, when he was about 10, maybe a bit younger, maybe 6, we used to play a game called Age of Empires, where basically it's like two battling sides, and you fight each other, and you're on different computers in a different room. And as part of that, you can play a game called Kill the King, or you regicide. And the idea really is normally what you would do is you'd hide your king in a castle or some other sort of defense. And I played it with him one time, and I could not find his king. I destroyed every building. And do you know what he'd done? He put him on a ship, and he was sailing the king around on a ship. And every time I went near where he was, he moved away. And I thought, so creative. And he also did another one where he basically would just chuck a load of soldiers into my area and build a castle, and a castle would start attacking my own players. So you're right, you know, you sometimes just need to have conversations with other people who just do not even think the same way as you do, because you just never know what comes up.
Amen. So, amen.
Yeah. So how does that then, you know, when you would look wider at, say, the way that AI is starting to become more useful in organizations, is that going to change the way that people can actually work with data? Is it going to empower people to be more proactive, more creative?
Yeah, Chris, I think we're on the cusp of an evolution in how people work. We talk about the revolution of AI, but what I'm seeing is organizations are embracing sort of organizational improvisation, I like to call it, which is you have teams that ebb and flow. They join up to solve a problem. They collaborate and learn, and then they break up again and go solve other problems. It's kind of like watching a really good soccer team play.
Right.
And how the ball moves around, and their formations ebb and flow, and they play off the best of each other. And the best soccer teams don't just have the best player. They have the best team. And so this idea of how do you empower people to more closely collaborate within teams, you know, it isn't the individual that's going to be the person that is successful. It's going to be the individual who can motivate the team and create a team. So I think we're going to see this organizational improv, where there's a book written called Team of Teams, which talks about this very well, about how these teams are going to ebb and flow. And I think the reason why this is going to be so critical, Chris, is I think that AI is going to force humans to become more human. That seems right. Like a weird statement, right? But AI is going to take on all these mundane tasks that humans have been doing. Well, that'll free us up to do things that we do really well. Like, we're very compassionate, usually, right? We also have a creative juices in us, if you can knock off all the baggage we've got. And it'll force us, the humans, to become more creative and more human. And again, I think you're going to find that collaboration and creativity and the ability to embrace diversity of perspectives to really fuel that empowerment of teams.
Yeah, I like that, because it's nice to sometimes be able to just free your mind and go away and think about something without any encumbrances around it. And that's not always possible when you know you've got deadlines or you've got other things pushing you. So yeah, I think the more we can get AI to help us out here, the definitely the better we're going to be.
Amen.
That was a fantastic conversation. We've just talked for like half an hour, and I'm struggling to remember all the things we talked about because we just talked about so many. Within Hitachi Vantara, where can people find you? And also, seeing as you plugged your book already, you did a very good job there. As long as you send me a copy, you can quite happily plug it and tell people when that's coming out and, you know, where to find you online.
Sure. So you can find me on Twitter at Schmarzo, S-C-H-M-A-R-Z-O. I'm actually pretty active on Twitter around data science and digital transformation and IoT. I don't talk politics because that only makes me frustrated. I'm also on LinkedIn. You can find me there as well. The new book probably won't be out until November timeframe. It's my fourth book. It's really designed for people who are very serious about wanting to understand some of the economic aspects of data and analytics. It won't be a light read. It'll be, like I said, it'll be a real snoozer. But again, I hope that's out sometime in November, and it should be available on all, Amazon and other standard places.
Great. And people have got three other books they could go and try first. So we've got a little bit of time before November for people to go and do a bit of light reading first before they come onto book number four.
Yeah, the one I recommend if you really want to get a feel for a lot of things I talk about is the Big Data MBA. That's my second book. The first book is called Big Data. It was one of the first books written about big data. But as I wrote that, I realized that it was too much on technology, not enough on the business aspect. Everybody's talking about technology. And to be honest with you, write a technology book in this time and age, 2 years later, it's immaterial. So Big Data MBA is a good starting point.
Perfect. Bill, thank you very much for joining me. It's been great fun, and I look forward to catching up with you again in the future.
Thanks, Chris.
You've been listening to Storage Unpacked. For show notes and more, subscribe at storageunpacked.com. Follow us on Twitter at Storage Unpacked or join our LinkedIn group by searching for Storage Unpacked Podcast. You can find us on all good podcatchers, including Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and Spotify. Thanks for listening.